Welcome to Homeschool Companion, your source for information, motivation, and inspiration. If you're part of the homeschool community or simply interested in learning more about home-based education, stay tuned. Together, we'll examine the latest resources, learning styles, and teaching techniques. We'll speak with experts in the field to help you uncover every homeschool advantage. We'll also present suggestions on how to keep Christ in the curriculum as we explore fresh ways to teach and learn. Here's your homeschool companion host, author, educator, and children's ministry specialist, Dr. Rose Gamblin.
Welcome, welcome to Homeschool Companion. Today with me, I have Eric Campman. Eric is an Ivy League educated person, a New York book executive. Campman's Christian testimony is as unlikely as his personal economic recovery, and we love to hear about economic recovery during these times. Campman's career in publishing includes some remarkable milestones. He recently teamed up with conservative stalwart
Al Regnery
to publish The Ruling Class. And this features
by Angelo Cordovilla.
And this features a foreword by Rush Limbaugh. Am I correct on that? He also generated reams of controversy for publishing If I Did It by O.J. Simpson, an autobiographical account of the murders of Nicole Simpson and Ron Goldman. But before we continue with this interview, we want to take time out for our kids. And kids, we're reading the story, Bicky's Cow College.
Last week, we left off where the horses had run away and Hod had run away, and Bicky had saved the horse with the tank
on
it.
You know, when I think about him, I wonder, how can a kid have so many adventures herding cows?
I know, at 10 years old, no less.
Yes, it's amazing.
And Bicky had run into his old teacher, Sam Drake.
And that's another thing. God always brings, you know, he'd lost his father, but God provided this other male figure that was so important, his teacher.
That's right. And so here we go. He turned to his old teacher again. Are you still teaching? No, Bicky, I'm in the insurance business, and that is what brings me over here into Story County. Tomorrow, I have to give a speech to a group of salesmen on successful salesmanship, and I want that piece of a hat you are wearing. Will you sell it for a dollar?
Bicky grabbed off the old ragged felt hat he wore and looked at it.
What good would this old hat do you?
He looked at the fine hat Sam Drake was wearing.
I'll tell you, Bicky, I want it to illustrate that you can't measure people or judge them by the clothes they wear. I want to make that point in my speech. Take it!
Bicky thrust the worn hat towards Sam Drake.
It's all yours, but you can't run fast enough to pay me one red cent for it.
By this time, several other men had joined the group at the barn door. One of them said,
Mr. Drake, I own this threshing rig and the tank wagon, and these horses are mine. If your school teaching turns out young fellas like this chap, then I think you've made a big mistake to leave your teaching business for insurance.
Everyone laughed and pounded Sam Drake on the shoulder. The owner of the threshing rig wasn't done.
You can all see that this young fella has saved me several hundred dollars today in damages that, because of his quickness and courage, did not occur. I intend to reward him right here with $10. Is that all right with you, Alan?
Uncle Alan nodded, and the man put $10 into Bicky's hand. Then all the men threw their hats into the air and gave three rousing cheers for Bicky Ross, the herd boy. Bicky hesitated only a minute. He had caught a slight movement in the hay down in the nearest manger. He wondered what could have made the hay move up and down like that. He ran back down to the herding grounds to Jim.
I'm sorry, Jim. It took me a little longer than I expected. Oh, Bicky, I wish you could have seen how you looked scrambling up on that tank wagon with those horses running like demons, and you stood up there holding the reins like some big general. I'll never forget it, Bicky, never, so long as I live.
Then Jim told how disappointed he'd been about not seeing the fight with Hod.
But this was better. It was the best of all. Nothing could be so grand as this.
The two boys lay down on the warm, damp grass, and Bicky told Jim all about what had happened at the barn and showed him the 10 silver dollars.
I think you should take half of them.
Bicky began to divide them.
It wouldn't have been so good if the cows had gotten away while I was bringing the team back. No, Bicky, I will not take 1 cent. You can't make me. It would spoil the fun I've had today.
Then they started to talk about Hod.
You know, Jim, I think I could have answered the question about where Hod had gone. I could have told him he was hiding within 10 feet of where they were talking and that he heard every word they said. Why didn't you tell them, Bic? Why didn't you let them drag that cowardly dog out and give him what was coming to him?
Bicky didn't speak for a minute. Then he said,
I just think it's better this way. But where was he? Under the double feed boxes nearest the door in your barn. He had pulled the manger hay up around him, but I could see from where I stood right outside the door. The hay sort of heaved up a little like this.
Bicky showed with his hands.
At first I thought maybe it was a mouse or a rat, but no rat or even a cat could have made the hay move the way it did. I'm sure it must have been Hod,
Jim said.
I still think you should have told everyone where he was hiding. He needs a good licking.
Bicky got up to bring old Satan back into the herd, and when he came back, he said,
You know, Jim, I think maybe we are too hard on Hod. Some people get dreadfully frightened by lightning and thunder. I suppose they can't help it. They just go crazy or something like that. Well, men don't act like that. Little boys might be scared and run, but I never saw a man do it. I used to be a little scared of lightning myself when I was small,
Bicky said.
Mother used to tell me to not be afraid because it was only God's wagons rolling across the sky. You didn't believe that, did you? No, I don't believe it was wagons in the sky at all, but I'm not afraid anymore. I enjoyed it today, but I think I've got welts from those hailstones. Turn around and let me see.
Jim ran his hand over Bicky's back and then pulled up his shirt and looked.
Man alive, you got welts that look like a case of chicken pox.
Then both boys laughed, and Bicky said,
I'm sure that whatever Hod has hurts much worse.
And that concludes Chapter 9, and the next time we're together, we're going to read Chapter 10, and we're reading Bicky's Cow College, one of my favorite books. I'm here with Eric Campman, and just prior to our story, we were talking about some of the experiences that he has had, and we mentioned the book, If I Did It, the account of the O.J. Simpson story. And I'd like to not make that the whole focus of the interview, but I know that we need to get past this before we can get on to what we're really going to talk about today. Now, you conducted many high-profile interviews about this book, but I'm sure you weren't always, your motives weren't always considered the best here. But you did this to help support the Goldman family.
That's correct, but, you know, the world and the way they looked at O.J. Simpson, it was a universe with the trial, with the not guilty, with the whole series of events that happened after that. By the time O.J. Simpson contracted to do the book itself, a lot of people had sort of put it to everything to rest, but not the Goldman family. And when it was announced the book was coming out in November of 2006, the Goldmans and the Browns rose up as a single voice, mm-hmm. along with many people in the population and the everywhere, and stopped the publication of the book. Fast forward about 6 months, and the Goldmans won the rights to publish that very same book. If I Did It, which is very ironic because you would think they stopped the publication. They're not publishers. They're citizens. And so they came to me through a series of events, and I brought the book into market. We got it to number 2 on the New York Times bestseller list. We sold approximately 180,000, and the Goldmans, for the first time, earned back some of the money O.J. Simpson owed them. More importantly, partly because of the publication of the book, I won't go into the details of it, but partly because of the publication, O.J. Simpson is in jail today. So I consider the attacks on me personally for publishing the book would be misguided, but this happens all the time. People just didn't know that actually I was working with the Goldman family, and I was working on the side of justice, not injustice. And while it's very ironic the way it worked out, the Goldmans received partial restitution, but more importantly, they believe they received some of the justice that would have been denied them in the mid-90s.
Now, your journey went from success to what we might consider failure, and then back to success. And I know we don't have a long time, but we love stories because stories give us hope and they give us a view into what God has done in someone's life. So tell us first your success and then what might have appeared failure, and ultimately what good came from it.
Well, I started, I'm going to be very brief here, but I started as a lowly sales rep in 1970 at Viking Press, and 7 years later, I was the national sales manager at Simon & Schuster, one of the biggest publishers in New York. Ended up being vice president director of sales. Started my own company after leaving there. I kind of went from the giant ship to the little tugboat. I've always been an underdog kind of person. I like to fight for the underdog, so I was perfect. I was going to work with smaller publishers and try to get them the same place in the sun that the bigger publishers already had. And I was very successful at that, I mean, for years. However, I keep on saying I knew half about what I needed to know to run a company, and the half I didn't know was the financial half. And so in a way, as I look back on it, I remind myself a little bit of the state and federal government. I was hoping tomorrow would be another day, kind of, to quote...
optimistic.
I was very optimistic, foolishly optimistic, that you cannot sustain debt. And I was trying to do it. I was marvelously creative in doing that. But the end was in sight. And in 1989, I went into Chapter 11. And that's when the Lord came into my life. He knocked on my door. I'm not sure I knocked on him, although I did go and pray. And I did buy a Bible. But I was fighting in this terrible storm, this financial storm I was dealing with. The bottom line is the greatest success I ever had came through my greatest failure. Because I faced my troubles. I did everything in my power to restore not only the people I was dealing with in terms of business, but restore my reputation and my place and move on a whole different basis, which is really by when I came out of Chapter 11 in 1991, I was not only spiritually a different person, I was, from a business point of view, a different person, and they interrelated in my business and spiritual life. The business started representing my spiritual nature as much as my practical nature in running a business.
And now I hold in my hand this wonderful book called Signposts. What led you to write this?
I would say God did. Actually, I have a very specific family story. I started reading the Bible on an everyday basis in 1991. I found a lectionary. I loved it. I read it to this very day. So I'm in Scripture every morning. I can't stop it. Till the day I die, I will be reading in Scripture. That's the way it is. I really loved doing that. And my son, my oldest son, who now works in my company, was going off to camp, summer camp, for 6 weeks up in New Hampshire. And I decided to write down a Bible verse a day on an index card for him, and I duplicated it for me so that he and I on the same day would be reading the same verse. And we did that all summer long. And that was actually the origin for the idea of the first book I did, which led to a second book, which led to the final devotional I'm writing. I'm not writing another one. I think that this represents the what the Lord would want from me in this thing. And this is going to lead to ministry, to teaching, to all kinds of things. It's led to a website, which is signpostforlife.com, one word, signpostforlife.com. And in it... one of the best features of the new website is that I do a 3-minute daily podcast with the senior pastor in my church so that he and I are talking back and forth about the passage for the day, developing kind of a conversation along the lines and those lines. And I think it's getting better and better.
You have been listening to Homeschool Companion, a production of MRG Media. Be sure to join us on Facebook. Just type in the name Homeschool Companion. For more on this or to contact us, go to mrgmediaministries.com. That's all one word, mrgmediaministries.com.
Now, why did you call it Signpost? What's the significance of that?
Well, I have been out on the trail for most of my adult life. This year, on August 3rd,
Now, by trail, you mean...
Literally.
Appalachian Trail.
I've been hiking the trail for a long, long time, and I'm going to finish it this year. And that's, I think they think it's 2,178 miles. It changes every year because they're doing, but that's what I think it is. And I've done 1,850 miles, and soon I'm going to do another 50, and then by the end of spring, I will have 84 miles in Maine to complete, and I'm going to do it with some friends. Get to the top of Mount Katahdin, my deceased mother's birthday, August 3rd, one day before my birthday, August 4th. So my celebration on top of Katahdin will be completing the trail, and I'm doing it before I click into another age.
So each of the signposts along that trail, that's like the metaphor of God's providence in our lives, the relationships he brings, the directions he gives us. So that leads me to family. You mentioned your son. How has your family been involved in your journey?
Well, I have three sons, one daughter, my wife of 41 years. I think they've been involved in incredible ways. I mean, in terms of the hiking, in terms of they've watched me. I think that they're relatively typical of their generation in that they're dealing with things that 20-year-olds deal with rather than 40, 50, 60, 70-year-olds deal with. But anyway, I think they admire what I'm doing and like it. And I think that it creates a foundation for them. It's a tightly wound family. I mean, we go on vacations together. We didn't have children for 11 years, so my children are basically, still young in a way. I mean, my oldest child is 31, so...
That's young.
Yes, it is young. But I want to go back to what you were saying about signposts, why the title, because I think that really does have a... it does represent the Pilgrim's Progress in a way. The way I look at it is on the Appalachian Trail, there's a blaze, a white blaze that gets you to the next place. And in a way, I think that represents the way we live. You know, we talk about faith. We talk about belief. But in a way, everything we do is faith-based. Everything we do. Whether we're if you're a non-believer, I don't know how you get to the next day without believing the next day is going to come. And so, trouble is a lot of people believe in things that really aren't helpful. But on this, the purpose of the signs on the trees on the trail is to keep you from going off to the left, going off to the right, getting lost in some way. They want you to be on the right path. And I think God wants the same thing from us. He puts up signposts in our lives that try to keep us on the path that is leading towards him, following Jesus towards Jerusalem, following and learning, following and learning. And it's a never-ending process. There will be, in terms of my life, the last day that I on earth, I will still be learning. I will still engage in the very mystery of existence. So I think it's a wonderful title.
It is. Now, has there ever been a time where you got lost on the Appalachian Trail?
Yes, last October.
Well, tell us about that, and then I know we have to come to a conclusion, but we love stories, so tell us about
that. Well, total foolishness. I was not looking, and I got to a place called Humpback Rocks up in Virginia. I'm actually going back to cover the miles I did not cover. And I was thinking in my mind that the trail was straight ahead, and in fact the trail had gone off to the right. And I was with two companions, and they had gone off. They were ahead of me. I had lost vision, lost sight of them, and I just kept going straight. And then when I got to the rocks, which was off the trail, I didn't know what to do. Where's the trail? And there were all these trails around because it's a tourist attraction. And I couldn't figure out where the trail was. And the smart thing to do would have been to go back. But there were too many places that looked like the trail. So I went down a mile to the road. And fortunately, there was another trail that went that took you back to the Appalachian Trail 4 miles later. So I just got out there and waited for my two companions, and they eventually showed up. They were looking for me, of course. The bottom line on getting lost in the woods, it is not something you ever want to do, especially when you're with other people, because it's almost impossible to find them. I mean, you can be 100 yards away, and you can be as lost as if it's 5 miles.
Well, do you have cell phones with you?
Had a cell phone. So I had a cell phone. One of them had a cell phone. Luckily, it was on, and we did connect, and I said, just stay. When you get to the intersection, just stay there. I'll be there.
Yeah, because a few years ago, it would have been virtually impossible.
No, it would have taken all day. I mean, yeah. I didn't even know where the trail was. Now I do.
So you didn't follow the blaze.
I did not follow the blaze, and I've spent many good years of my life missing the blaze. But now I'm looking for it, And so I think that metaphorically I'm looking for it. So as running a company, for example, I'm always looking for the blaze. I don't want to get lost. I know what it's like to get lost. I've gone through a bankruptcy. That's lost.
Mm-hmm.
It's why I'm very concerned about the American economy, because the people in Washington, D.C. do not know the trouble they're heading for. They have
yes.
no idea,
yeah.
and it's huge.
Yes. I was just going to conclude with the question, during these economic times, what phrase or encouragement can you give our listeners as to how to stay the course and not go under, not to lose sight of the blaze?
Well, I'm going to give you an odd answer here. I think life is not progressive.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, every day is not better than the last day, or every journey is not just going up or going flat or straight line. And I think when you get to an economic bump in the road, you have to reconsider your position and reconsider what what you're willing to do to get back on the road. I mean, sometimes when you're lost, you have to, and it's not just being lost, but it's finding yourself in a tough economic position. You have to move back. This happened to me 2 years ago in my company. And I took immediate action to prevent a cash flow drain on the company. And I only learned to do that because I learned to put fear aside when I'd gone through a bankruptcy. So dealing with fear and not being afraid to do to being unafraid to do something is huge. So, and I'll give you an example. If you were a director of something in a company, if you had a position, a high position, it is okay to start lower.
Mm-hmm.
If you can find a lower position, especially if it's in your talent framework, so that you're good at carpentry or something, and you were a manager of a building company, well, sometimes it's okay to start again because at least you're in the game and
mm-hmm.
doors open when that starts to happen. So I don't believe that going backwards is a bad thing. Sometimes you just do it. It's strategic. You get on your feet again, and then you move forward. And probably if things work in your direction, you're going to move forward at a very accelerated rate, because all of that experience is a huge asset you carry with you.
Yes. Well, share with us again your website information and your contact information so they can get the book.
Well, the book is available everywhere. So it's available at Barnes & Noble and Amazon, and virtually every place that sells books in America could get it. You could get it, barnesandnoble.com. What I really want to encourage is people to begin to – we've been working very hard to get this website right, to get it to be a community. So it's signpostforlife.com. That's one word, signpostforlife.com.
And it's the word four. Sometimes people put in the number.
No, it's not the number. We thought about that. when you're typing and you have to go to the number, sometimes that's just not nice. And
well, for radio, it's very difficult because we always have to say the number four. So now we're saying it's just all words.
F-O-R.
You know, that's such a great testimony. I know there's many people on a personal level that are having to take jobs that are maybe not as sophisticated as what they've been in, but I think the words of encouragement that you're giving to them will hold them true. You do what you need to do and just follow the blaze of Jesus Christ. Thank you so much for being with us on the show, and we'll make sure that we put your information on our website as well. And at this, we'll say God bless.
You have been listening to Homeschool Companion, a production of MRG Media. Be sure to join us on Facebook. Just type in the name Homeschool Companion. For more on this or to contact us, go to mrgmediaministries.com. That's all one word, mrgmediaministries.com.